with. Joining us now by telephone is Jim Lardner. Jim, are you there?
I am.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Jim Lardner is the Communications Director of Americans for Financial Reform. And there are all sorts of things happening in Washington this week. We talked about the IRS imbroglio. A little bit earlier in the show, but there's a vote coming up in the Senate. And Jim, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit of the backstory on that vote, because it's really what we're going to be talking about with you this morning.
Well, we're talking about one of the cleanest and potentially farthest reaching of the reforms that followed the financial crisis and the economic meltdown of 2008-2009. It was the creation of a financial watchdog agency with the explicit mission of protecting people rather than protecting banks or the, quote, financial system. And since we're in Massachusetts, it is important to note that this was Elizabeth Warren's idea back when she was a bankruptcy expert and concerned about the various slippery lending practices that were driving people into bankruptcy. And she pointed out that if you tried to sell a toaster that had a 1 in 5 chance of exploding a week later, that would not be allowed, and there should be an agency that takes similar action against loans that have a 1 in 5 chance of exploding. So anyway, in the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, this agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was created. It has authority over banks and non-banks, over checking accounts, credit cards, payday loans, private student loans. And it's begun to do some important stuff. It's protected veterans and members of the military against illegal foreclosures and various financial scams. It's put out rules against all kinds of tricks and traps in mortgage lending. It's done a report and maybe preparing to take action against payday loans with, 300% interest. It's provided a place for students and people with student loans to register their complaints and often get action. But the financial industry and its friends in elected office have a plan to put an end to that. And it all revolves around this confirmation of a director. The nominee is former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray, who has in fact been the director since January 2012, having received a recess appointment from the White House then. And his nomination is before the Senate now. It goes before the Senate this week, and there are 43 senators who have threatened to use the filibuster to block even a vote on this nomination, not because they have anything against the nominee. In fact, many of them have spoken very positively about Cordray. They are trying to kind of eviscerate the agency. And their idea is that they will withhold action on the director nomination, demanding, quote, reforms of the leadership and the funding that would, in fact, really bring an end to its ability to stand up for people and stand up to banks and slippery lenders.
I know that your organization is nonpartisan. Is this collection of 43 senators nonpartisan, or perhaps we should say bipartisan?
No, a strictly factual account of the matter requires saying that they are all Republicans, and that they are all the Republicans in the Senate with two exceptions. Two Republicans did not sign the letter threatening to do this, and it's not clear that either of them really disagrees with the rest. So we're talking about 43 Republican senators who could use their filibuster power to block a vote on this nomination. It's one of a number of nominations that the majority leader has expressed exasperation about, and there have been, you know, stories about whether there might be some drastic action, the so-called nuclear option, to make it possible for the Senate to act with just 51 votes.
Jim, what aspects of the law governing the activities of the Bureau are they looking to weaken?
They would like to have it led by a 5-member commission. These commissions are, which exist with some other agencies, such as the Federal Trade Commission, the one that and the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the one that regulates toasters, are typically filled with members chosen by the party leaders. And since it's so hard to get any nomination approved in today's Washington, they often end up being completely gridlocked. They don't have a full membership on the commission, or it's, you know, 2 and 2 who don't agree. So that's one of the reforms. The other reform is that it should get its money from annual congressional appropriations rather than, as the Dodd-Frank Act specified, out of a share of the budget of the Federal Reserve, where the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is in fact housed. So these things were decided by Congress in 2010, and now there is a group of senators who are trying to rewrite the law, trying to use the confirmation process to make changes that they could never possibly get approved of directly.
We're speaking with Jim Lardner. Jim Lardner is the communication director of Americans for Financial Reform. Jim, when you're listening to these 43 members of the Senate, and they're writing this letter saying, you know, we've got to stop this, what have they charged has been the sort of egregious action? What sort of overstep are they suggesting has been committed by this this body thus far?
It's interesting. They don't. In fact, at the Senate Banking Committee hearing, although the vote was strictly on party lines, people had nothing but good words to say for Cordray's leadership and for much of what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has done so far. So they claim to be interested in the abstract, in greater accountability and other, you know, high-minded principles like that. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who organized the letter of the 43 senators, when appearing before the American Bankers Association several weeks ago and talking about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, he said, if I had my way, it wouldn't exist at all. And so that seems to be the real agenda here. It's the idea of an agency that actually has some independence and some authority and that can stand up to the banks is what the financial industry and its allies are opposed to. They don't necessarily want to come right out and say that. So they talk about, you know, accountability and other stuff that is really nonsense. It's nonsense because the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has many checks on its authority, and as its critics concede, has been extremely balanced and careful and given a hearing to all comers. In fact, some bankers are now have spoken positively about it and basically don't seem to be any more exercised or don't seem to be exercised any more about its existence. The political assault on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has become a little bit unhinged from from reality. You have to ask yourself, you know, who are they really representing, other than maybe, you know, the absolute scam artists of the financial industry.
This is Radio with a View, and we're speaking with Jim Lardner about the consumer financial. Consumer
Financial Protection Bureau.
You say that some banking institutions are interestingly enough not as critical of the regulatory oversight as you would imagine. What about some of these financial institutions that deal in the sort of financial instruments such as derivatives and things that we started to learn as regular consumers started to learn about post 2008 credit swaps and that sort of thing?
Well, they're not so. It's not, the same institutions may be upset about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or have views about it, but the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, of course, doesn't really have any direct involvement in derivatives because they're not an ordinary consumer product. The mega story here is that this was a landmark piece of legislation, the financial reform law of 2010, the so-called Dodd-Frank Act, and we like to think that these fights end with the passage of legislation, but it's a little bit like, you know, one of those movies that ends with a marriage, and you have to wonder, how will these people really get along? Implementation is just tremendously important, and one major lobbyist for the financial industry said when that act was passed, said, halftime. You know, this is not a defeat, this is just halftime. And ever since, they have been trying to roll back all of the toughest aspects of that law, including derivatives reform. Two House committees, the House Financial Services Committee and the Agriculture Committee, have recently voted for a whole package of bills that would have the practical effect of once again allowing banks that have insured deposits, that are backstopped and subsidized in various ways by the public treasury, to gamble in fancy financial instruments for their own short-term profit. So there's that fight, the derivatives fight. There's the fight over the so-called Volcker Rule, which is closely related to that, that would restrain the gambling in general by banks. There's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Those are the things that the industry is trying to water down, delay, stop, undermine. And my coalition, Americans for Financial Reform, which is more than 250 civil rights and consumer and investor and other groups, is kind of working hard every day in Washington to try and stop this assault on financial reform.
Jim Lardner, when you look out at the partisans who are not the bankers who are saying, well, you know, this isn't so bad. This is going after the bottom feeders. One of the revelations I've had in the reading that I've done, often to do interviews with authors on this show, is how tightly interwoven the top reaches of finance in the United States are with the lowest bottom feeders, the 300% payday loan folk who are, you know, a step below the mafia in the way I look at it, and at least the mafia lives in the neighborhood, and that these folks are really, you know, quite vicious in how they approach their their population, their market, and yet they are tightly connected through financial interweaving with folks at the top. Is that something that those elements of banking who are hostile to this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau are actually not willing to talk about?
Absolutely. They're connected in two ways. They're connected in the way you referred to, which is that there are many large banks or bank holding companies that one way or another have investments in payday lending companies and private student loan companies that that fleece people and so forth. And then on top of that, there actually are a number of big banks that are doing these payday loans or the equivalent themselves, although to their great credit, a couple of the financial oversight agencies, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency and the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, have begun to take some strong action, or it looks like they are preparing to ban bank payday lending, and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau seems to be on the way towards taking general action against payday lending, and there's something like 18 states that have done so also. When the plot to cripple the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is in part a plot to continue to make the world safe for 300% and higher percent lending, whether it's by banks or by your fly-by-night storefront.
Jim, we've learned over the years how the core of lobbyists in Washington has grown exponentially. There's probably tens of thousands of lobbyists working to, in one way or another, weaken regulation including this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. How is your coalition meeting the challenge? In terms of being up against such a large force, and how are you parsing your resources? You know, who are you approaching and concentrating on speaking to, in terms of using your limited I would imagine what are limited resources compared to, as I said, these tens of thousands of lobbyists representing the financial industry.
That is absolutely true. There is an overwhelming financial and material and personnel advantage that the financial industry brings to all these battles. The one thing that the other side, we have going for us, is that when the light is shined on one of these questions brightly, many of our elected representatives in Washington are too ashamed to vote for the interests of Wall Street, the mega banks, and the payday lenders, et cetera. And that's how financial reform got passed in the first place. And with all its compromises, still it contained some pretty strong provisions. That is to say, strong if they were carried out. The Senate has been, on the whole, unreceptive to some of the, you know, like the derivatives bills I referred to earlier, which have moved forward in the House. Senator Tim Johnson, who is now the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, has been a strong defender of financial reform. There are some powerful voices, Elizabeth Warren's and Sherrod Brown of Ohio, in the House, Maxine Waters, who is the ranking minority member of the House Financial Services Committee, took a pretty gutsy position against some of these slimy derivatives bills a week or two ago. And there have been regulators who have followed through with courage, notably Gary Gensler, who is the chairman of the little-known Commodities Future Trading Commission, which has jurisdiction over a lot of these derivatives rules. And they have been patiently and persistently and, on the whole, honestly writing rules to restrain, you know, the excesses, to, for example, prevent banks from just being able to funnel their derivatives transactions through overseas affiliates and then say, well, the U.S. has no authority over that. So, you know, we both communicate with people on Capitol Hill and with the regulatory agencies every day of the year.
Mm-hmm. If the group of 43 succeed, or if the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as envisioned by Chris Dodd and Barney Frank, is successfully weakened, just give an example or two of how this affects the average bank consumer who has money in the bank and has to pay fees, or maybe a homeowner who's paying a mortgage. How will it affect them?
Well, let me talk about some of what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has done. It has returned close to $500 million in penalties and refunds to nearly 6 million consumers cheated by credit card companies. It went with, along with other regulators, it went after Discover, Capital One, American Express over the aggressive marketing of often worthless or wildly overpriced credit card add-on products. It's begun to write rules that would bar teaser interest rates and other tricks that make mortgages appear to be more affordable than they are. It has provided a place for students to go to lodge complaints against private student lenders and many students, I should say, and also people who are no longer students but still have student loans. There are indeed in this country, there are people who are on Social Security who still have student loans, have often been able to get some real recompense over these complaints. And now, in a really dramatic, potentially important step, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau put out a request for people who have these loans to actually suggest what can be done about the problem of having impossibly expensive student loan costs. And 30,000 people responded over the last couple of months, filed their comments on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau website, and proposed ideas for policy changes. So we have a real advocate for the victims of abusive and high-cost student lending. The agency has protected military families against illegal foreclosures and other scams. It's done something for people who are in this country and who send money to their relatives overseas, so-called remittance payments. In the past, the fees have been completely opaque. Now they're clear and they're limited, and the companies that do this have a responsibility to make sure the payment actually gets through to the relative it's, or friend it's intended for. They're investigating bank overdraft fees. They're beginning to do something about credit reporting and debt collection, which has been a totally out of control market. So, you know, I guess the way to generalize all of that is that the work of this agency is beginning to make all those totally incomprehensible and deceptive and trick and trap laden financial contracts that, you know, have become a part of all of our lives for a generation, to bring an end to that day, bring an end to that era. What's at stake now is, you know, whether the industry can go back to just doing kind of anything that it pleases that makes a short-term profit and it's everybody for himself.
We're speaking with Jim Lardner. Jim Lardner is Communications Director of Americans for Financial Reform. Jim, we need to do some station business that will hopefully satisfy the federal agency and our station management that has oversight over us. Can you stick with us for a little while? We'll continue our conversation when we return.
Indeed.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. You're listening to Radio with a View on WMBR in Cambridge. I'm Mark Stern. He is
Dave Goodman.
And we will be right back in just a couple of minutes.
Hi, my name is Angeline Grant, and I'm the host of Coffee Time, a program of jazz every Friday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. We listen to hard bop, bebop, West Coast and cool, early and vocal jazz. Plus every so often, jazz from the movies or TV. And at the end of the show, little bit of gospel, little bit of soul. So join me for Coffee Time here on the station that's first on your FM dial, 88.1 FM, WMBR, Cambridge.
Is there really such a thing as a safe place to put your money? And where would that be? Under the mattress? Stuffed in a cookie jar? No. You want real safety? Find out about the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. It protects your money, up to $250,000 in bank accounts like checking, savings, and CDs. And talk about solid. In 75 years, no one has ever lost a penny of FDIC-insured money. Better odds than your cookie jar. So if you have $250,000 or less in any one FDIC-insured bank, you have no need to worry. Your money is fully protected. If you have more or aren't sure, visit FDIC.gov or call 1-877-ASK-FDIC. The more you know, the safer your money.
And if you've got lots more, you can send a very substantial check to me directly here at WMBR, and I will transfer it directly to my daughter's institution of higher education, where I send other pennies that I get.
Mark heard that there are people collecting Social Security who are still paying student debt,
yeah.
Student loan debt, and his head nearly exploded. He's got one in college. I've got a second one coming up in through high school who will be in college, hopefully next in 2 years.
I wasn't sure if Jim, welcome back to Radio with a View. I wasn't sure if the person paying the loan was actually the parent who's now on Social Security or
student. It's both. Take a look at the 30,000 comments on the CFPB's website. One of them is there are plenty of these, first of all, that of people who are on in years who are paying student loans either on their own behalf or on behalf of children. But there was one woman who said, "I'm 70, and I'll have to go on working forever to pay off my student loans."
Yeah. Well, that brightens my Sunday a lot. I want to thank you so much. We're speaking with Jim Lardner. Jim Lardner is the Communications Director for Americans for Financial Reform.
Jim, I don't think it's a stretch to think that your coalition has the ear of Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's been an advocate for this for a long time, for this sort of regulation. Can you tell us at all what you know of Ed Markey or a wild card in the upcoming senatorial race in Massachusetts, Gabriel Gomez, the Republican? But can you tell us anything that you know of their stand, either Marquis or Gomez's stand on weakening the regulations from Dodd-Frank?
Sorry, I'm out of my depth there.
Okay.
Well, and Markey, of course, is in the Congress. He's as our representative in actually, he's my representative to Congress.
I don't think either they haven't debated yet. I don't think either of them have been asked a question about this
about
yet.
This, no.
Yeah. All right.
But let's continue a little bit about Elizabeth Warren. What has she been doing in relation to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and this battle over the question of leadership and formalized leadership? And what role has she been playing?
Well, as you know, she helped set up the bureau, and she was considered to be the obvious candidate to lead it, and the Obama administration eventually gave up on getting Elizabeth Warren confirmed as to lead that agency and chose instead her deputy, former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray. She is now a senator as a result. Had the Senate decided, been moved to approve her nomination, she might well have been nominated for that post, and who knows, the world might be different. Now she's in the Senate, and the Banking Committee, which she sits on, had a hearing on confirming Mr. Cordray a few months ago, and Elizabeth Warren asked one of those questions of hers that often go viral on YouTube. She didn't ask this question of the witness, but rather of her fellow senators, and she asked them, "You're trying to change the funding mechanism of this agency, and you're trying to change its single director leadership to a commission. Why do you not object to the many other regulatory agencies in Washington that have single directors and have similar funding arrangements?" And she ticked off some of them, including a financial watchdog agency, the OCC, and others, and that was a very powerful question, because there is no consistency or logic to what they're demanding. There are many other regulatory agencies that have directors, as this one does. There are others that do not get funded out of annual appropriations. And in fact, many have argued that those qualities, those characteristics, are what give you an agency with a little bit of gumption and ability to be independent. The big question now is, you know, what can be done? What's going to happen? And there are some senators who one assumes among those 43 who really don't want to be, who do not want to appear to be against financial reform, to be supporting the agenda of the big banks, and you know, we have to put pressure on them, maximum pressure. There are people like Susan Collins in nearby Maine who voted for the Dodd-Frank Act, and Rob Portman in Ohio, and Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, and many others.
And by the way, just out of curiosity, and what was the response to that question when posed?
Oh, it wasn't a question that...
we might speak of it as a rhetorical question.
Yes, yes.
All right. It would have been nice to actually have somebody try to answer that. One of the ways you try to beat through the tens of millions of dollars in the coffers of lobbyists who are being funded by the financial sector is to actually approach... and try to successfully gain real coverage of these issues. As you put it, you shine a light very brightly on the question, and you make it impossible for those who are opposing to actually hide in the shadows and cast a quiet vote. When you do, what has been the response generally to trying to do that? I mean, that requires that media in all forms and in all sectors of our society really pay attention to this. Has the media been doing that? Have you been able to get that word out? And what are your thoughts on that matter?
We think we have a winning struggle here. We think that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will survive and be strong because its opponents do not represent real people. They don't even represent the entire financial sector. They certainly don't represent the business world. Many small business people in today's America are very critical of the mega banks. There have been polls which show that small business people are overwhelmingly supportive of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and most of these folks self-identify as Republicans, so it's not a partisan issue either. In fact, the polls are absolutely consistent. The idea of a financial regulatory agency that supports, that looks out for consumers, is hugely popular. It's popular across the country. It's popular among people regardless of party. So I think ultimately the enemies of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will have to give up their fight. The struggle is to get them to give it up sooner rather than later, and to make them see that they are just doing themselves no favor by this. Because there's no base for this. There is no popular support for this position.
Does the recent question of the IRS make things harder for you? Does it really allow cover for folks to hide and say, well, this is just another governmental overreach. Look what the IRS has done.
There's always going to be stuff for people to hang their hat on who want to denigrate government and suggest that government can never be a force for good. And it's, I guess I could say that in the long run, what the IRS has done in terms of targeting certain conservative groups for scrutiny on the when they apply for tax-exempt status is bad, and probably, thank goodness, the work of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for good greatly overshadows what the IRS has done mm-hmm. in terms of its impact on large numbers of people.
Mm-hmm. And Dave and I were speaking a little before you came on with us about the fragmentary memory of those who have ignored the decades of obstructive action by the Justice Department against anti-war activists, the raids on various groups, the seizure of documents, often illegal in the middle of the night by various Justice Department actions, that somehow those don't seem to get the same play and concern because it's not them. But you've been doing this for a while. Has the situation changed in Washington over the last 5 years? How has this environment changed for you to pursue your work?
When Senator Carl Levin and his, I should say, John McCain is also a co-chair, I believe, or a vice chair of the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigations. When they do investigations of the credit rating agencies or of the London Whale scandal, you see the revelations that come out of of those investigations have a tremendous impact. And once again, you see the mood shifting in Washington towards taking strong action to rein in the excesses of the banks. We did not have, unfortunately, after the financial crisis of 2008, we didn't have the single kind of riveting national investigation that took place in the 1930s, the so-called PCORA hearings. But still, public opinion has been overwhelming in favor of financial reform as a concept, in favor of particular things like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. A number of organizations that we work with, including Consumers Union, the AFL, have joined with us in a petition which now has 160,000 signatures, which is being delivered to senators all over the country and in Washington as well, saying, back off, permit an up or down vote on this nomination, and don't use the confirmation process and the filibuster to try to rewrite a law that was already passed and that is supported by the overwhelming majority of the American people. And you can see that the tone is changing. There have been individual senators who have said, who have spoken in the past with total scorn about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Senator Graham of South Carolina described it as something out of the Stalinist era. You'd almost think he was talking about, you know, the KGB, when, you know, what it's doing is things like requiring that mortgage contracts be clear. Now their tune has changed. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, despite the fact that he is one of the signers of the letter threatening to filibuster this nomination, said to Director Cordray, you've done a wonderful job. They recognize that the work of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is enormously popular, and they're not willing to be identified as they do not want to be identified as opponents of financial reform or opponents of consumer financial protection. And so it's our job to make sure that anyone who blocks the nomination is identified that way, because that is the practical effect of blocking this nomination. It is to bully this agency out of effective existence.
Jim Lardner, just one more question from me, and that really has to do with a sort of an overview of banking as it's gone on. When the crisis hit 2007, 2008, there were both a set of failures and a set of successes, many of which were bailed out by the federal government on the principle of too big to fail, that to allow everything to go down that would have gone down would have meant collapse and financial ruin, not just in the United States, but really globally, that this was about a global financial collapse. And so the United States government, that is to say, the United States as a nation, the people of the United States, bailed out banks very actively, especially the largest banks. And they were not stupid. They took this opportunity to capture the assets of many of the banks that failed. And they became larger, bigger. Eric Holder has suggested, it's not clear that he said it explicitly, but that they're just too large to control. We can't really regulate them. They're beyond the ken of us. They've created these derivatives and structures of exchange that are so complex, mere mortals can't handle it. And we've seen that they, as mere mortals, can't handle it, so maybe there's some truth to that. But that they're beyond regulation itself. They can't be regulated. When you listen to that kind of language, how does the concept of too big to fail connect with an environment in which many of us in this nation say, if they can't be regulated because they're too big to fail, break them up?
too big to fail, and as Elizabeth Warren put it, too big to jail.
Right. Just break them up.
There is increasing support for some form of breaking up, and a number of people who are in the Federal Reserve System have spoken up for that. A number of bankers have spoken up for it, although generally they are retired bankers. Perhaps most notably, there is a bill that was just introduced in Congress, in the Senate, by the bipartisan duo of Sherrod Brown of Ohio and David Vitter of Louisiana, which would require that the biggest institutions set aside a particularly a higher threshold of capital reserves. And so if they did not wish to meet that requirement, they would have to downsize. And we're talking about the difference between trying to regulate in the micro every little thing that these big institutions do, which is extremely difficult, and looking for sort of bright lines, strong, clear rules that are easier to enforce. And there seems to be a movement afoot now, gathering strength to deconcentrate the financial sector for exactly the reasons you've described. And it still doesn't have, the kind of support to get legislation passed, but it's moving, and we're very interested in keeping that process going.
Jim Lardner, if people want to establish some contact with Americans for Financial Reform or learn more about what's going on in this area, where can they go?
OurFinancialSecurity.org is our URL. OUR, financialsecurity.org, Americans for Financial Reform, and you will find there many ways to get connected and to do things like sign letters to your senator or call senators, which is, by the way, another fine thing to do in the next week, is to call senators tell them to support a simple up or down vote on this nomination. This is, of course, not a problem in Massachusetts.
Well, we are carried all over the world on the World Wide Web at WMBR.org. And for those listening over the web, welcome to Radio with a View on WMBR. Jim Lardner, I want to thank you so very much for joining us this morning on Radio with a View. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Have a great day. Jim Lardner is the Communications Director of Americans for Financial Reform. And so...